What is up, TPN? Back at you with another podcast. It is I, Adam. I am here with Dave Hesserun, which I've been practicing how to say that. And Dave is a retired Air Force dude who's done a little bit more than that in his life. He runs High Country Air Service out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's flown, I think, a million different types of airplanes. I think I counted. I think it was 17 total different types of airplanes he's flown. He's got a few less type ratings in that, but he's still fairly qualified. Before we get any further into all the other great stuff Dave is doing and has done, I have to ask, because I want to fly one. I want to own one. I want it to be the TPN official airplane that we, Matt and I and Jason, get to fly around and visit all of our TPN members. Is how did you get the ride in the OV-10? And how many times did you fly?
That's a great question. Cool story. The short version is it was part of thesis research. So public service announcement for everyone who is looking at their IDE options. I highly recommend you put Naval Postgraduate School on the top of your list, because I can almost guarantee this would never, ever have happened at ACSC. But my thesis partner, Grant, not so sharp, now also a retiree, and I partnered up to do a paper on light attack aircraft back in 2009, 2010. And we wanted to do some research on, you know, light attack aircraft options. And one of the options was a privately owned OV-10. And so we got some time in it down with an organization in Florida called Stallion 51. So plug for them. They also run P-51 flights. So you could check off two things on your list at the same time, you know, go ride in a TF-51 in the backseat of that, and then maybe get an OV-10 ride.
Wow. Well, I think I just put that on the podcast guest list, Stallion 51. We're going to give them a call. That seems pretty cool. I've had one luck of sitting in an OV-10 at an air show where I was doing the static displays down in Florida. So it might've been the same guy. I don't remember his name. And it was very cool. And I've always got a soft spot in my heart for that. Not only airplane, but mission. Not being a light attack guy, or not being anybody who's ever shot anything out of an airplane, it was always my hope that one of my guard or reserve units would get flopped over in a light attack aircraft when I was younger. Now, old man's game. I'll be more than happy to be initial cadre, but the kids can go deploy for me on that one. I've done plenty. Well, we kind of jumped a bunch of stuff there to get to the OV-10 discussion, but I had to ask right off the bat. First off, I want to thank Dave for joining us. Second off, I want to thank Dave for being one of the newest partner sponsors of TPN. And this is really not only mutual benefit, because Dave started his business, came out to TPNX last year. We barely knew who he was. He barely knew who we were. We've grown a lot closer since then. Dave's also got a lot of opportunities for networkers. So that is what we'll get into as we go along here. But we want to welcome him to the fray as a partner and a sponsor. Without Dave and others like High Country Air Service, we don't get to do things like TPNX or have this podcast or anything like that. So call this an infomercial, as it were, but I guarantee this will be better than any ShamWow video they've ever ever heard. Except maybe the guy who bit his tongue off in some sort of weird party thing, but I don't think we have to worry about that. So let's rewind a little bit. Let's talk about how you first got into this whole aviation biz, and how it started and how we got to here.
Sure. So I, like a lot of the members in TPN, learned to fly in the military. So I had never flown I think I had maybe one ride in a Cessna somewhere in middle school or something, but I always wanted to be a pilot. So the military seemed like the best way to go about that. Did a whole Air Force career flying C-130s, AC-130s, and Dornier 328s. And then shortly after I retired, I kind of found what I thought was my forever job as chief test pilot for Honeywell's flight test hangar here in Albuquerque. And unfortunately, forever was only about 20 months, and they decided to consolidate all of the flying to Phoenix. So I needed a new plan. And I'd always been intrigued by the possibility of having my own business. I knew that it had to be something related to flying. And as you had mentioned with the OV-10 in the beginning of the podcast, I kind of got reintroduced to general aviation. The OV-10 wasn't the only plane we flew at NPS. We flew a couple of other things too, including Super Cubs. We got some pictures of that on the website. But when that happened in 2009, only about, or 2010, about 6 years before my retirement, it kind of planted the seed of what might be possible in general aviation. And so in 2018, after I had to suddenly leave, you know, what I thought was my forever job, I thought, well, maybe this is that opportunity to start that business. And so I jumped into it with contract flying, and fast forward a year and there's no day job anymore. There's just High Country Air Service. And we've got subcontractors working for clients. We have some local clients that we service managing and flying their airplanes, and things are really taking off literally.
Well, let's, you've covered a large swath of time in a very short period there. I think, so being a gunship fan, because I was a guy who refueled gunships all the time.
And thank you, by the way. Thank you very much.
Not a problem.
We could not get that job done. And I got to say, Adam, you guys, I'm assuming you're a 135 guy, right?
Yeah, have been my whole career.
Yeah, you guys, you're gutsier than we are, because at least we have defensive systems.
I think ignorance is bliss.
Dude, coming down to our altitude and giving us gas in Afghanistan, if you ever get a chance, I'll put a plug in here for my buddy Mike Jansen. I mentioned him at my retirement. Amazing story for the medal that he earned in Afghanistan. In an AC-130 getting gas. But anyway, hats off to you guys for what you did, giving us gas over there.
So I think it's very interesting that you bring that up and the synergies of how guys and gals work together, especially out in combat, right? We all joke around with each other, but at the end of the day, it's, you don't get boots. We're all part of the support team. No matter what airplane you fly, whether you are an F-35 guy or you're an AWACS pilot, you fly C-130s hauling rubber dog stuff out of Hong Kong, or you are flying C-5s over the tracks, or you're broken a KC-10 in Hawaii for a month. No matter what good deal or bad deal you think you may have, to include Predators, Reapers, and all that other good stuff, the bottom line is boots on the ground or boots on the ground. We're all just, the entire United States Air Force is a support system for actual troops in contact on the ground. No matter what you fly, what you do, pointy edge of the spear of the dude holding it, it doesn't matter. That's what you do. And I think it takes some folks, a lot of us, a career sometimes to figure out that that's what we really are. That whether you are the finance person or the pilot, you are part of the support system for, Tom Smith, who's 19 years old, who's just learned to fire an M16 a year ago, and now he's on the front line, wherever that front line might be. And I think one of the cool parts about being connected with the gunships and their background, that whole AFSOC world, is we got to see stuff, even from a tanker perspective, that was slightly different than the rest of the community who didn't get to go do that AR. And So I kind of want to ask a question about that world, and how does that world that you saw in the gunship world translate now to you being entrepreneur out on your own? Because in that world, you are not on your own at all, almost ever. You have support, you have SATCOM, you have fire control officer, navigator, defensive systems guy. You have all sorts of stuff. You have us in the tanker. You have your base isn't that far away.
Right.
Now you're the boss. You're on your own. What's the transition and what's the translation?
So you would be shocked, I think, at how well military service, you probably aren't shocked because you are an entrepreneur, but a lot of people who have not jumped into entrepreneurship yet and are currently military members or recently separated or retired military members would be shocked at how well your military service prepares you for entrepreneurship. Because no problem that I ever faced as a gunship aircraft commander or instructor or weapons officer was ever simple. They were all complicated. And I never had perfect information, and I never had perfect resources available. And everyone in the military can relate to those constraints. Well, those are the exact same constraints that I have as an entrepreneur. I don't have unlimited, I certainly don't have unlimited resources with a startup, and I don't have perfect market research. I just have some hunches that I can chase down and some leads. And then I have some allies like you guys, like TPN. And so what I do as an entrepreneur trying to solve these market problems is very similar to the problems I tried to solve, you know, on active duty. It's just that the metric that we use to evaluate it is a little bit different. So, you know, on active duty, our metric was how many Taliban did we kill or how many Americans did we save in combat? And now my metrics are all dollars. But I'm still trying to work within the constraints that I have and handle strange, ill-defined problems.
What a unique way to look at it. So here's an ill-defined problem, and I want to talk about some of these kind of stories that you had that you shared with me.
Sure.
And because this one is, there's no other way to talk about it. Talk about when what you wrote me in, and I'm looking over the notes here. You met your wife, who wasn't your wife at the time.
Yeah.
And then you went to deploy. And you guys are still going strong. And by the way, I will tell you, wife of a military pilot who flies a lot, almost identical support to wife of entrepreneur who has to go, hey, honey, you've got the kids. I know I just got home from my other job. This is me talking. I got to go do this podcast with Dave. So that kind of stuff. Talk us through that.
So I don't think I could have prepared my wife better for being married to an entrepreneur than having her be married to a, you know, AFSOC guy for 15 years.
Yeah, I bet.
I've actually known my wife over 20 years. You can't make this stuff up. My roommate at the academy, Jeff Lohmiller, huge thanks to him. Like, my children owe their existence to my roommate because he introduced me to my wife. So they were friends in high school. He introduced us. I only ended up being his roommate because I think we're like about an inch apart in terms of height. And so in formation, we sized close to each other and we got running and started talking and became friends. He eventually introduced me to his best friend from high school. Fast forward 8 years. It's Afghanistan had just kicked off. It's December 2001. And I wasn't on the first wave from my squadron to go, but couldn't wait to get over there to do my part. And they had an opportunity for a chief of tactics to go over and relieve the overwhelmed tactics office over in Sib, Oman. And so I volunteered and said, yeah, absolutely. Take my IP school slot. I want to go to the fight instead. And I had a layover in DC on the East Coast where my now wife was then going to graduate school. And so, you know, I just called her out of the blue and I was like, hey, you know, I'd seen her before. We'd, you know, met in a social context that was just friendly. And at that particular time, she happened to be on one of her week-long breaks between five-year relationships. And I just, through the grace of the Air Force, I ended up geographically, with geographic proximity to the woman who became my wife. And we, you know, went on what turned out to be a date. And it went really well. And so while I was deployed, I wrote her a letter or an email, because it's, you know, 2001.
Sure.
Relatively modern times. I wrote her an email every day for 110 days. And she answered me every day. And then when I came home, we started dating, and, you know, 18 months later we got married, and we've been married for 15 years and beautiful daughters. And, anytime my wife would bag on the Air Force, I was like, well, the Air Force brought us together. And if it wasn't for the Air Force, you know, we wouldn't be here. So thank you, Air Force.
Well, you're saying thank you, and maybe she's saying, well, you know, no, of course not. Yeah, of course not. That there, you know, those stories are great, but that one, I mean, to be geographically on the way and just happen to be like, yeah, you want to get together, and how that works out is,
you can't make this stuff up, man. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And if that's the case, I'm probably the luckiest guy on earth.
Sometimes I think I'm lucky, better lucky than good all the time. So I think I don't want to go down the story path too much because there's just so much to discuss. And if we do stories all day, which maybe we'll save that for another podcast at a different time, because we could do the AFSOC, and I think maybe we'll just do a gunship story day, and you can just pull out some old gunship stories that'll get because that is of a lot of interest to myself and other folks anyways, but that's not what we're here doing today because that's not what the plan is. And
sure.
As much as I want to go down that road, I also know what that road can lead to. And yeah. It'd be a lot of BSing. So let's move into, so you have this Air Force career, you're coming up on retirement, and you see the encapsulated piece of retirement where you're going, and this was in 2016, the airlines had started to hire a little bit. I'm guessing you probably had gotten yourself a little bit ready beforehand. So take me the 18 months prior to retirement, what's going on in Dave's head, talk about the family and where are you guys going to go from there?
So 18 months prior to retirement, I had spent about 6 months at Cannon. My last assignment in the Air Force was Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. And not unlike a lot of guys who end up at Cannon, especially after leaving a staff job at Ramstein, family wasn't super excited about living there. So I moved them to Albuquerque, knowing that this was my last assignment and we weren't going to stay in Clovis anyway. So I lived in an Airstream trailer for 2 years. I had a super short commute, like, 5 minutes from my door to the door of the squadron. And that I had that super short commute 5 days a week. And then 2 days a week, I had like a 3 hour and 15 minute commute as I drove back to Albuquerque to see the family on the weekends. So 18 months prior, I had just finished, I got qualled in the Dornier. And then I left on a deployment to run JASOAC South for Southcom. And then, or Sock South, excuse me. And I was thinking about retirement. Entrepreneurship was like a maybe idea. I hadn't really given it much thought. I was really focused on getting an airline gig. And so this is a little bit of foreshadowing for what I'm going to recommend later. Make sure all you young guys get your logbooks up to date. So 18 months prior, I was trying to rehabilitate my logbook after leaving it dormant for way too long. And then starting to fill out airline apps. And then I signed up for this TAPS class. You know, they have the transition assistance program for people who are separating or retiring. There's another free public service announcement. You can go to that multiple times. I went like 2.5 times. So I went once while I was on my staff job in Germany to get an idea. And I realized, wow, there's a ton of stuff I don't know about being a civilian. I'm going to have to do this again. I went another half time, probably a year after I'd been at Cannon with essentially 1 year left to go until retirement. And I only made it halfway through that because I had to stop to go do my IP upgrade in the Dornier. But then I did it one last full time about 3 or 4 months prior to retirement. And those remaining times, the idea of entrepreneurship really started to take hold in my mind. And I was like, you know, they have this whole track in TAPS class about becoming an entrepreneur. And the big takeaway I got from that is, there are an enormous number of resources available for people who are interested in starting their own businesses. And the problem is not that there isn't help. The problem is that there's so much help that the Small Business Administration or the Air Force or DOD will offer you. You have to make time to take advantage of all that help and incorporate it. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing when you and Matt were launching TPN, but the number of people available are mind-boggling.
Yeah. No, well, TPN was such a different animal. It didn't become a business through anything other than evolution. And Matt had the brainchild of saying, what are you doing to make TPN a business? Cause I don't know if a lot of the listeners or TPN members in general know that the original idea of TPN app, or I shouldn't say the original, but the first evolutionary idea of TPN was to make it a nonprofit organization. And we went through Matt, after Matt came on board with me, one of the biggest issues that we had was trying to figure out what do we provide that's nonprofit. And we realized that you can't really make an ethereal, intangible network a nonprofit organization. So we, I wouldn't call it a pivot. We just, we canned that idea and said, let's try something else. And that's, I think it was around the same time that we got introduced to a couple of nonprofit organizations that we'd heard of in aviation who are just kind of starting out. And they had something that they were specifically trying to do that was more nonprofitable, I guess, if you want to talk, speak of it that way. And we decided at that point that the right move for TPN was to become an LLC business. Once we did that, we realized that we can raise money, create revenue through sponsorship with responsible companies and corporations like High Country, like, well, Soft again, Bose. We, I mean, that announcement is coming up in a future podcast, but we do have a relationship with them, or Milt ATP, or a lot of our other sponsors out there. We can generate revenue through them, and then we can kick that back into the network and also over to our nonprofit organizations that we want to support, like pre-flight camps, professional pilots of tomorrow, et cetera, et cetera. That was a very interesting piece. One of the things that I didn't know after I realized that I was now an entrepreneur, I had been for 5 years at that point. I didn't even know it. I still sometimes wonder, am I really an entrepreneur? It's like, yeah, you have, you help, you're part of a triumvirate of three business dudes who collect revenue, and you then go and create product or create content or manage and administrate things. Yep. That's what an entrepreneur does. And one of the things that I noticed as I got further into this was that I didn't know there was any help out there, and I never looked for it. I just did kind of blindly went through it, listened to some stuff on podcasts and did that. But and then started reading some material, not knowing that there was active free assistance that I could get. Once I got to my guard unit, that petered out. It's not as prevalent at the smaller outbases, if you want to call it that, in the guard and reserve as much as the big installations like when I was at MacDill. So to hijack what you were saying, I wish I would have known more. And I think not only do I wish I would have known more that there was, that it was accessible, I wish I would have had a mentor to guide me through and say, do this, do that. This is the base foundation. These are the things that you need to look at. I'm not telling you what to do, but if you look at this, your life's going to be a hell of a lot easier. And then once you clear these hurdles, then the world is your oyster and you can go do whatever you want to do. And then you come back to me or go find a mentor who's got more experience. And what's really funny is I've noticed is people have actually come up to me and asked me those questions as I've grown into this. And I'm saying, well, you know, we're really small still. And they say, yeah, but you're still doing it. You've created revenue out of something that most people couldn't figure out. And I said, yeah, it took Matt and I a lot of chat, a lot of talking, a lot of hand wringing, sometimes not the most kind words to each other to figure it out, you know, and here you are figuring it out as you go, not realizing that that support agencies, that those kind of support agencies are out there. And then when they are out there, how to parse out the loads of information that, because some of it's not very helpful. It's just too much.
Right.
So I think, and that's exactly what you're saying. There's just too much.
Yeah. It's funny what you mentioned about mentors, because I had a very similar experience, and this is kind of a tangent. You could do a whole podcast on this, but it's funny how in the civilian world, of which I'm still a new member, having only been retired for 3 years, but veterans like just find each other just randomly. Like they just kind of stand out. And I've been in very different contexts where I'm just like, yeah, that's a really great guy. And we get to talk in and it turns out, oh, he's a veteran. He's an Army guy or Navy guy or whatever. Well, I ran into a veteran in randomly here in Albuquerque, and he's now a mentor for my business. He's an entrepreneur, started a nonprofit, former Air Force pararescue and CIA agent, and now CEO of this company. And the mentorship that I've gotten from Nick has been just absolutely amazing, and fantastic advice. But it's emblematic of that network of veterans helping each other to get the job done. Just like you were talking about at the beginning, where, you know, we're all part of the same support team, in combat, whether we're giving gas or, you know, we're sending 105 rounds downrange or, you know, providing ISR, all part of the same team. And I think veterans who are in business understand and see that out in the real world. And it's just, it's a very natural networking relationship that evolves out of that background.
Yeah, totally. I think it totally does. And to get to entrepreneurship, you had to go, so you're in these TAPS classes, you're doing your thing, and you're going, I'm airlines. Retirement hits. Now, are you ready? Are you at retirement, you're hitting terminal. Were you ready to go? Did you have ATP, all your stuff done? And what did the career field look like for you at this point?
Yeah. So again, greatest good deal ever. I got my ATP under the old rules pre 2014, where you did not have to do the ATP CTP course. Mm-hmm. So I took the ATP written while I was still on staff, because I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. I knew, you know, next assignment was only going to be 2 years long and it was going to be my last.
Yeah, it wasn't that light at the end of the tunnel. Wasn't the oncoming locomotive.
No, thankfully, no. It was not the bullet train coming from Paris to Kaiserslautern.
Yeah.
But I had the ATP written done, and I'd gotten some gouge, again, the network, from my bros who'd gone on to fly the Dornier, and they said, hey, if your ATP written is done, when you go to CAE in Toronto and you take your type check in the Dornier, you can just make that an ATP check, and you get a type rating and an ATP out of the same thing, and it was free. So, again, greatest good deal ever. I got that ATP rating done with the type in like 2 years before, a little bit less than 2 years before retirement, and then spent the remaining
Hang on 1 second, Dave. Hey, you want to say hi to everybody? So everybody, this is my daughter, Lydia.
Hi, Lydia.
Lydia just wants to say hi to the pilot network. Say hi, everybody.
Hi,
bye. Okay, great job. Can you go tell mom that you said hi to everybody? All right, I'll see you later. So that's what you have to look forward to for those single pilots out there running the show.
Yeah.
And that's why we do what we do. It's a total blessing. So sorry about that, Dave. So you got the good deal, ATP. Yeah. I was trying to do the same thing in my career. It didn't happen. I had to go pay for it out of pocket. This is before Mil-2 ATP existed.
Yeah.
And I did mine I did mine down in Florida in about 3 days. It was rough. And I was told that, be glad that landings weren't a part of it, 'cause I probably wouldn't have passed. I knew you were going to ask that.
Like an Aztec or a Baron or some twin engine.
Maybe it was a Warrior a twin. I can't remember.
No,
not a war. It would have been, I think, so it would have been an Aztec then. 'Cause it was
this Piper Aztec.
And it was a piece. It was absolute garbage. And I didn't know what I was. I didn't like, I honestly, if from what I've heard from the way ATPs were given out when I got it to how they're doing ATP, how examiners look at ATPs nowadays, there is no chance that I would have been able to get an ATP the way I flew that airplane. None. Absolutely none. I think we flew twice on the first day, twice on the second day, and then check ride. And plus ground school in the morning, and then afterwards. I think it was like 2 days of maybe 10 to 12 hours. It sucked. It was not doable. It was very challenging. I did not feel confident after that. And when I went in to go for my first interview, I didn't think I was ready to get hired by a civilian company, but they did. And I was a contract guy, so I learned rapidly what I didn't know at that point. So it was an experience, not one that I would recommend to anybody else, but it was an experience that I got. And I think, because when I left active duty, I was not ready at all. So you were ready. You had your ATP. You were walking out the door going, life's good.
Yep. I thought. But through that summer, I realized just how difficult the seamless transition is. Like, it is really tough to, a year out, put your retirement application into the Air Force and say, all right, I want to be out on this day. And then do all the work so that your class date lines up at your new airline, bam, right on that day that you're out of the Air Force. And it just didn't line up for me, unfortunately. So plan B, SkyWest was hiring. I went to SkyWest and thought, well, this is a good way to learn the 121 world and, you know, make a little bit of pay as a retiree and then hopefully go on to the airline career. Well, I had simultaneously, again, back to my wife, she said she found this job, this Honeywell job, just searching online while we were on a road trip. And she's like, hey, how about this chief test pilot thing? And I was like, bah, they'll never hire me. But I threw an application in anyway. And about a week before my check ride in the CRJ at SkyWest, I had an offer, a written offer from Honeywell. And it was like 5 times more than SkyWest paid. So, and it was in Albuquerque. And I thought, all right, this is a no-brainer. Why take a check ride that I don't need? So I politely resigned and went to work for Honeywell at what I thought was my forever job. And it was awesome. I flew lots of different airplanes. We had like 5 different planes in the hangar, everything from a 182 to a, I think the biggest thing we had in there was a Beach Baron. And we got a Piper Malibu, which is 350 horsepower, turbocharged piston engine. And then I also got to fly some airplanes from our sister hangars in Phoenix, including a Citation V. And I got a type rating in that, which was amazing. So kind of fell in love with general aviation all over again. And it touched back on what I had initially discovered in 2009-10 when I, you know, got a little bit of a taste of it at NPS. But unfortunately, it closed. Like, they moved the hangar and they said, hey, it makes more sense for the company to have everything in Phoenix. I'm not a huge Phoenix fan, no offense to all the Phoenix residents out there, just a little bit too hot for my taste. I kind of prefer, you know, the Four Seasons we get here in Albuquerque, and I wanted to stay. And so entrepreneurship, I thought, well, this is it. The universe is giving me a sign. This is the opportunity. It's a bummer that they're closing the hangar, but this is an opportunity to, you know, go after that entrepreneurship dream. And so I jumped in with both feet, and my last day at Honeywell was my first day on a contract trip for my company.
All right. Now we got to get into that, because what you did contract wise and what I did contract wise are two wholly different things. I was hired out as a contractor to work in Afghanistan, flying Beech 1900s. I, to be honest with you, I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I couldn't see myself deploying like that for a very long period of time. But for the short run, absolutely right up my alley and fun, because I'd never done anything like that. How does one go from being the chief test pilot at Honeywell in Albuquerque to, well, looks like I'm going to lose my job, to, you know what, I'm going to figure out how to become a contract air service? Because that, I can't get from point A to point B on that one. I've been trying.
It's actually a little more logical than it sounds.
Okay.
But what I've learned in the, you know, year or so that I've been an entrepreneur full time is that you got to find the puzzle pieces where they are, and then you bring them together, and then you've got your whole. So the business is the whole picture, and I've got to put the pieces together. Well, one of the significant pieces was, if you're going to be a Part 91 GA contract pilot, you need a lot of GA experience. And I got hundreds of hours flying kind of the core of the GA aircraft market as the chief test pilot for Honeywell. So I flew 2 different Cessna 182s. I flew a Piper Malibu Mirage. And I flew 2 different Barons, and then the Citation V, and a little bit of King Air time in there. And so if you want to talk about what's at the core of the GA market, you look at planes made by Beechcraft, Cessna, and Piper. And I fortunately, again, just blind luck, I looked into that in my job at Honeywell, and I got some really great training. I mean, how many people know that you can do a simulator-based initial training on a Beech Bonanza? Well, as of a few years ago, Flight Safety in Wichita was still offering that. And I was able to do that. And I got fantastic knowledge from these guys who've been flying bonanzas for like 30 years. And wow, it was fantastic. And then I'm in the sim learning the G1000, which, you know, how many straight military guys have ever even seen a G1000 or could identify it in a lineup? I mean, but it is this amazing piece of kit, and it does its job so well. You just need a little bit of exposure to it.
Sure.
And so I just fell in. I had this piece, this GA piece that I got from Honeywell. And then I took this piece of that I learned a little bit about entrepreneurship from the TAP class back before I retired. And I had happened to already, back in 2016, like 2 days before I started with Honeywell, I incorporated so that the date of my LLC would predate my employment with Honeywell, just so there wasn't any intellectual property issues there. And then the LLC just kind of sat there for 20 months while mm-hmm. I worked the day job. Well, I just picked that back up after I left Honeywell and started, you know, adding the business checking account and then adding the accountant and just put these pieces together. And before you know it, you got a business.
All the other stuff that comes with that nobody thinks about. Because I was going to say, so let's talk about the idea, the genesis of the idea for becoming a entrepreneur in the world of contract air service. It's that's not something where, like you said, you predated your job at Honeywell with starting the LLC. So you knew it was out there. You incorporated your, okay, I'm good to go. Funny story about that. My first LLC incorporation was not TPN. I actually, I wanted to start a information disposal service, shredding. Yeah. I wanted to buy a used shred truck and drive around MacDill Air Force Base and get the contract to shred paper.
Awesome.
And I figured, okay, you know, I'm going to give it a try. I knew nothing. I had no work ethic or drive. So, so that LLC was the $117 LegalZoom in Florida business license, and followed by nothing after. So I think if I did it again, I would do it a little differently this time and maybe actually see if I could garner a contract or two. But yeah, I know the idea of setting something up and then letting it sit there for a while. Where did the genesis of the idea come from in the first place? How long before that were you going, you know what, maybe I want to do something a little different?
You know, I didn't set out to do contract flying when I set up the business. And mm-hmm. the name, you can probably guess from the name, is kind of aspirational. And that there are other things that the High Country Air Service is going to do in the future beyond just contract flying. But while I was at Honeywell, you know, I had the great chance to interact with some very highly qualified professional test pilots, civilian test pilots. And they had just mentioned casually about some things they had done when they were between jobs, including contracting. And not contracting like we as, military aviators think, you know, going to Afghanistan, which is totally valid and very lucrative. But these guys did it as civilians, all Part 91, essentially point A to point B. So that kind of got me thinking about it. And then just blind luck, I started cruising these pages on Facebook and found a client. I found a client here locally in New Mexico who needed a part-time contract pilot to help him fly. That it was actually the Meridian that was in the TPNX video. And so that, it's weird how things just line up. About, I found that client maybe 2 months before I left Honeywell. And so my negotiations with him were kind of overlapping as my exit plan for Honeywell was developing. Mm-hmm. And that's how I was finally able to achieve this seamless transition that I couldn't do leaving the military. So I was able to negotiate our terms of service and then set it up so that I would leave on my first trip for him on my last day at Honeywell. And that was the seamless transition.
That sounds like, to me, the first, the leaving the military transition was the, hey, let's give this a whirl, see what happens. And the second time through, you're going, you know what, now I can plan it out and I can more have a more organized methodology to how I'm going to attack this. And lo and behold, it worked out fairly swimmingly, I would say. I mean, there's always hiccups, right? Yeah, there's always hiccups, but it could have been far worse than that, knowing lots of other friends in not the same kind of position, but corporate world, who one day they show up and the doors are locked and, hey, we'll call you with your severance package. Or another good friend of mine who reported something at his company and shortly thereafter was not enjoying a paycheck from them. Now, he landed on his feet, no problem. Everything worked out very well. But some of these places, they don't have the same ideals that you do, or they don't have the money, or they don't have the resources to keep a flying operation open. Closing a hangar. Hey, this doesn't make sense anymore. They weren't doing it because they didn't like you. They were doing it because it didn't make sense.
Yep.
And that transition piece can be scary as hell.
Absolutely.
And I can't imagine going through that a second time, really, after you think that life is pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I was set when I got hired on at Honeywell, and I thought, oh, this is it. Like, I'm not going to do the airline thing. I'm going to do this. I made a whole spreadsheet comparing pay scales, and I was like, this pays a little less, but the flying is super cool, and it's home-based right here in Albuquerque. So I'm home most nights. What's not to love about this job? And then it just ended. So the huge lesson that I took away from that transition and then from my transition out of the military before that is you always have to have a backup plan. I mean, we all know this as aviators, certainly as military aviators, but that applies equally to your life. But one of the lessons that I learned, I probably read a bunch of books. I read a book, I think it's called Vetrepreneur by Jason Anderson. It was another guy that, we were actually pilot training roommates, and he had a lot of different businesses throughout his military career. But he wrote this book, and one of the lessons in there was about using whatever your current job is, whether that's active duty military or an airline job or whatever, that's your foundation on which you can build your backup plan. And so he said in his book, he talks about how the military, while you're on active duty, provides you this fantastic blanket of security, aside from the part where you're getting shot at downrange. But in general, economically at least, a very good, comfortable security blanket where you're getting a regular paycheck, you can depend on it, your family's taken care of, you got health insurance, dental insurance, all of those basic needs are met. And that frees up some mental bandwidth to think about what's in the future, what can I plan business-wise. And I realized as I made the transition from active duty member to retiree, that my retirement in a somewhat lesser way was the same thing. And so my military retirement is the economic foundation that allowed me to, suffer through two different big life transitions in relatively short succession, and then successfully launch this business. Because, I've got essentially guaranteed annual income from Uncle Sam for the retirement, thankfully. And healthcare is taken care of, and dental is taken care of. So I know that hopefully the business goes well, but if it doesn't, I'm not going to lose the house. We'll have enough to eat. Kids can still go to the doctor. And that gives you the confidence to kind of venture out and try something new, where the outcome of your new venture may not be as guaranteed.
It's not. The risk is not tied with your safety or security.
Absolutely. It's almost unfair. Like, as a military retiree who's also an entrepreneur, I've got this solid foundation. Like a guy off the street who decides to start his own business and he has to actually eat off of that, he might, that's a bigger risk. I didn't have to take a risk that was that large.
Yeah. I think one of the podcasts and somebody else I listen to, Gary Vaynerchuk, talks a lot about being hungry, and some people need that. Some people need that extra kick, and that the resting on your laurels being retired with a guaranteed paycheck is enough to go, I'm comfortable. I don't have to, I'm cool. Whereas other people need that extra, hey man, I'm hungry. I got to get out there and I got to make this happen. And I think that's, I've talked to a couple people like that in the entrepreneur world, and getting back to High Country Air Service and figuring out, okay, so started off with that trip the day that you leave Honeywell, which I find to be fascinating. And then you go from there to where you're at now. So a year later, here we are, High Country Air Service comes, can't make it to TPNX because it's too busy. Dave's too busy to show up.
Sorry.
It's totally, that's great. That's what we wanted to hear. There was no better way to call in and say, can't make it, guys. I've got business going out the wazoo. And if I don't stay home, the wife's not going to be very happy, and I need to have at least one or two days off with the fam. And you do. That's the most important. That's why we think we do almost everything we do. Is part of it's for a little bit of selfishness, but a lot of it's to our families. I mean, you know, playing dad when your kid runs in the middle of a podcast is the best thing that ever. I mean, I'd rather have that than not be able to do that stuff with my family. So this last year, what's that look like, and what is the future for High Country?
So in the last year, I was able to convert my every once in a while client here in New Mexico to full-time operations and management contract. So my company manages the flight department for them and for the client. And, you know, all the things, the care and feeding that you would imagine an ops squadron does is what I do. That's what I provide, the service that I provide for them. And then, of course, I can fly the plane as well. So fly the plane with the client if they want, you know, backup, because the plane is a Part 23 airplane, does not require an SIC, but it's certainly safer to have two pilot operation. I mean, you airline guys totally get that. Every airline under 121 is operating with two pilot crews. And then I'm maximizing the utility of the airplane for the client in that he has his own business to run that is not flying related. The airplane is a tool for him to enable his business. Well, sometimes his business requires him to go to meetings locally and he can't fly the airplane, but other members of his business have to go somewhere. Like at TPN, I had to fly two of his guys down to El Paso for a meeting. And so I do that. And so his airplane now has this greater utility because it's got two pilots who can fly it and operating more often. So the conversion of that client to full-time kind of enabled us to grow even more. Again, like we were talking about earlier, where you are currently is the foundation for what you can grow into in the future. And standing on that foundation now, as I started with the military retirement, layered on some contract work, layered on this full-time contract with this client, and now we're layering on top of that subcontract work. So we found a client in Austin who has some actually Part 25 airplanes that require two pilots to be flown around. And, you know, just like TPN uses a network, you know, I'm using the network of guys, fantastically qualified former military aviators, to fly that airplane for that client on subcontract for me. So the subcontractors make the majority of the revenue that those trips, like overwhelming majority of the revenue that those trips generate. But it's fantastic growth opportunity for my company in that it lets us get the name out there. It's free marketing, essentially, increased brand recognition, and great opportunity for some active duty or reservists or recently separated military members who are qualified on that airplane and want to kind of try before you buy. So they can come work a contract for me for say 5 days or 6 days. And if they don't like that client or they don't like that kind of flying, they never have to do it again. I mean, they'll still get their check for that trip and then go on their way. And maybe they decide to go to the airlines or go to charter or something else. But it's a really great arrangement kind of for all sides. And we're super excited to be enjoying that success currently.
That led perfectly into my next question. So Adam wants to come do some work for Dave. I want to go be a subcontractor for you or whatever you want to hire me on as. How does that, what does that process look like right now? What do you want me, what do you want me doing?
So the very first thing you got to do is make sure you have all your civilian ratings squared away. So if you're an active duty guy and you're more than a few years away from separation or retirement, you probably haven't even thought about your FAA ratings because you don't need them. Like Uncle Sam doesn't care if you have any FAA ratings. But it's super easy for you to get. You know, you can do military competency right after pilot training to get your commercial single engine if you flew the T6, and then commercial multi-engine, whatever you flew in your advanced part of pilot training. And then that gets you the commercial single and multi in an instrument. You can do, once you become an IP, you do mil comp, CFI. If you're a single engine, you'll get a CFI and a CFII. If you're a multi-engine guy, you'll get a CFII and an MEI. Get all that stuff done. Make sure that if you're flying an airplane that has a civilian equivalent, that you get the civilian type rating on the back of your FAA license. And again, relatively simple process. You fill out an 8710, an FAA form 8710, take it to your FISDO or a DPE. You show them your last Form 8 that shows, yeah, you know, I flew a C-146, which is equivalent of a Dornier 328. You get your type rating, and now you're good to go. And you got all that stuff. The other thing that you really need to be ready to subcontract for me is civilian medical. And again, if you're more than a few years out from separating or retiring, you probably haven't even thought about getting a civilian medical. So you need class 2 or better. Class 3 won't cut it. You know, I just went through this with a couple of guys. They said, well, I got my, you know, Air Force flight physical, and that's great, but the FARs limit you to operations that only require a class 3. And unfortunately, that's not anything commercial. So if you want to work commercially subcontract for me, you need class 2 or better. If you're already applying to an airline, you probably already have a class 1. So great. So you got those things good to go. Make sure your resume is good, and then send me an email. And we'll start the process from there. And I'll probably have some more paperwork for you to fill out. Everybody gets approved individually on the insurance of the client aircraft insurance policy. And there's a little bit of a process there, but it's really no more complicated than sending me an email, and you can find my email address right on the website.
So what is the pay, benefits, lifestyle look like for brand new subcontract that it comes and works for Dave in high
so
country?
Currently, there's no benefits. You know, I don't offer 401k or anything, you know, life insurance, all the things you would get at a big company or with the Air Force. I don't offer that. What I do offer is a day rate, and we'll pay you a day rate for every day that you're gone, whether you fly for the client or not, and flat per diem. And those numbers, just as an example, some guys I have going out, what's today, Tuesday? They're going out on Thursday, and they're going to get $900 a day, and then $60 a day per diem on top of that. And they get that for the full 5 days that they're gone. They have a travel day on Thursday, and then they're with the client, flying for the client on Friday, down day on Saturday, fly for the client again on Sunday, and then Monday they have a travel day to get back home on a commercial ticket that's purchased by the client for the subcontractor. So they're not out of pocket, any of that. And so they'll get that $900 a day or $960 a day, all 5 of those days. So pretty good chunk of change for those dudes. And then the other thing lifestyle wise is there's great freedom. So, you know, once you're on my list, so to speak, I'll just email you for a particular airframe and say, hey, who wants to take this trip? It's these days. This is the rough itinerary. You interested? And if they say yes, then we go from there. I build an itinerary for them and for the client. And then they buy their refundable plane tickets and they go and fly for the client. We process the invoice after the trip and they get paid. And if they don't ever want to do it again, they don't have to. If they do, great. If they have to skip the next trip because they're going on vacation with the family, no problem. You know, the next one down the line will be available and you can go on that one.
Sounds like it'd be a pretty lucrative and fun part-time job for somebody who doesn't necessarily want to fully commit to a work schedule of, let's say, a Part 121 carrier or going to work for even a corporate flight department where it might not be a full-time schedule, but the on-call nature of, hey, we're going to need you 20 days next month.
Yeah.
And I just spoke with JetLinks on a different podcast. Those opportunities of being part-time employment are there. And I think that people are forgetting about that. Now, the other thing, and we talked about this not too long ago, was that there's a whole nother side of this. It's not just the military guy who's getting out right now who's looking, oh, what should I do? It's the old captain who's just about to retire from Southwest or United or whatever, who's going, oh, what do I do? I still want to fly. And who's got a lot of GA. Some of them have a lot of GA experience. Others of them haven't done it for a long time. It's just a matter of getting them back into the swing of things. And this another group of people who listen to the podcast and are on TPN, hit Dave up. If you got a resume, you should have a resume. If you don't, put one together and you might be exactly what Dave's looking for to put into the, carousel. We were just watching Mary Poppins the other day. So the carousel idea came up in my head.
Great movie.
I think that freedom of contract work is something that is underestimated. I remember that. And although I didn't have the same types of freedom because of the way we set the way we were assigned our contract, definitely can be something great for the individual if that kind of thing works out. I know someday down the line, and Dave and I joked about it, I'll be the site manager from the Midwest when he goes up here
to Wisconsin.
Yes, absolutely. I think there now that it sounds like a great, perfect panacea of a job. What are some of the drawbacks that you see in this kind of work?
So that's a great question. The biggest drawback is also the biggest benefit, and that is variety. So there's lots of different airplanes that, you know, you can fly on contract, everything from a 182 up to like a Gulfstream, you know, G650 are all available in the market for contracting. Mm-hmm. But as you might imagine, there's also a very wide variety of maintenance and operational practices out there. And so this is one of the things that I discovered as I, you know, kind of jumped into this market, leaving Honeywell, is that I didn't realize how good I had it in the military until I left. For all of its faults and the things that I would love to fix about the Air Force, I almost never had an instance where I thought that the Air Force wasn't going the full distance to make sure that the planes were well maintained and well cared for. And I think that the same is probably true at most large 121 carriers. You know, excellent investments in safety and maintaining the airplanes. Well, some of that is true for some operators in Part 91, but Part 91 has very lax regulations for that stuff. I mean, there are things that you must do under 135 and 121 that are not even written down under Part 91. So like crew rest, for example, there are no crew rest requirements under Part 91. Minimum visibility for takeoff. You know, you guys have limits under 121 and 135. 91, just exercise good judgment. So with that large degree of freedom that Part 91 affords you, you need to bring a tremendous amount of flight discipline to take advantage of that freedom and use it responsibly. And so veteran pilots, former military pilots and airline pilots are uniquely positioned to bring that kind of quality perspective to GA contract flying, because you've operated in a much more rigorous, regimented environment that has strict regulations for how the airplanes should be maintained, how they should be operated, et cetera. And you can bring that perspective to a part of the market that is frankly largely unfamiliar with it, with the exception of some very large corporate flight departments that have a professional full-time director of maintenance, director of operations, et cetera. A lot of these small operators, they don't know what they don't know. And so I kind of feel like it's almost a social responsibility for those of us who have seen how the best way to operate and bring those techniques to that part of the market. Because people who operate these Part 91 airplanes, they don't want to be less safe than, you know, someone who's riding in the back of your plane for your airline. I mean, they would like to be equally safe. And I think guys that we bring in to subcontract, and hopefully myself as well, bring that perspective of a quality focus and a focus on safety and flight discipline to help GA operators in this lightly regulated Part 91 market operate to the highest levels of safety.
Totally agree. I think it behooves all of us to do that, just as aviators in general, aside from Safety is obviously one of the more important signatures of being a great air carrier, because you can use it as a marketing tool amongst other things. And frankly, when I think of it, I wouldn't put my wife and daughter and friends and family outside of that on any airplane I thought was being operated by somebody who wasn't good at their job. And if you're not in the, by not good at your job, I mean, it goes far beyond the safety piece of it. But that tends to be the something that gets brought up, because mistakes can lead, and we all have gone through the CRM Swiss cheese model. Mistakes can lead to the something very bad happening. And that's the thing we're all trying to avoid, whether for a multitude of reasons. If you bend metal and nobody gets hurt, you still bend metal, and it's going to cost. And if you work at a small operation and you bend metal, that could be the end of your operation for lots of different reasons. And that's the last thing you don't want. Somebody, you don't want to hire somebody who's responsible for that, and you don't want to be the one hiring somebody who's responsible for something that goes wrong.
So to answer your question, the drawback is that there's a large variety of operators out there. You got to be very vigilant as a contract pilot to make sure that, you know, things are being operated. You know what right and wrong is based on your past experience in the military or airline. And you just need to bring that perspective to your Part 91 contract work.
That's, couldn't say it better myself. Going into the final phase of this, because I want to get to these, because we talked about it. You even said, you're like, hey, I love this idea. So we have a little feature here called memory items or boldface items, depending on what your background is. And I think Dave gave some great ones, because I've already asked him this via our little outline, and he's got some really good ones here. So we're going to jump right into it. One experience that any aviator or aviation enthusiast must have going forward in their either professional or personal lives.
So hands down, you need to get a tailwheel endorsement and or flow plane rating. We as primarily tricycle gear pilots are hugely spoiled by the inherent stability that tricycle gear provide. So you can have a fairly poor crab landing in a tricycle gear plane, and the plane will straighten out and go straight back down the runway. That mistake is much less forgiving. The airplane's much less forgiving to that mistake if you're in a tailwheel airplane. And so going through the process of getting that tailwheel endorsement will make you much more attuned to what the winds are doing and much more conscious of what you're doing with the rudders, because you have to be. And then that naturally transitions to a float plane rating, because the stick and rudder skills that it takes to fly a tailwheel are perfect complement to float plane flying. And again, you got to be very attuned to what the winds are doing with a float plane. Though fortunately, unless you're landing on a river, you land on a lake, you can just turn into the wind. So the big catch with float plane flying is you got to assess what the wind is before you make your approach, but then just draw your imaginary runway the way that makes the most sense for you and land into the wind. Those are my two big things that, yeah, you got to do it.
Okay. Well, it's on my list. I don't know when that list is going to get to, but it's on my list. One of those two, at least for sure. All right. Something that you have told young Dave, just starting out in the aviation industry, that he must absolutely do.
So I told myself two things, and I did one of them and I did not do the other one. So the thing that I told myself to do was to get the FAA ratings as I went. So as soon as I finished pilot training, I did the mil comp FAA test so I could get commercial multi-single instrument airplane done. I have a FAA license. And then once I got a C-130 qual, I went and took my Form 8 and my 8710 to the DPE, paid them $100, and I got L382 type rating on the back of my license. And you just keep doing that as you get more quals. You get an IP, mil comp, CFI. I did that right. Unfortunately, I did not follow my own advice to keep up with my logbook. So I was good through the end of my first operational assignment in C-130s. I had like all of pilot training and 4 years worth of flights dutifully recorded in my pencil and paper logbook. And then I went to the war in AFSOC, and 7 years later, I hadn't recorded a single flight. So fast forward, it's like a year before I'm going to leave staff, and I realize, oh man, I'm going to get flying again. I should probably catch up this logbook. And I spent many hours copying from my A-forms printouts onto my paper logbook. So I had an actual logbook that I could use for my post Air Force civilian career. So if you keep up with it, it's much easier. And back in those days, Milkeep didn't exist. It would have been awesome if they did, or at least I didn't know about them if they did exist in 2014. But whatever you do, keep up with your logbook.
Yeah, I'll second that. I did not do that either. I definitely don't have it now with Delta and all that stuff. And the problem isn't the Part 121 carrier. It's if you don't want to go do that, if you want to go work somewhere else, it's very those copies of garbage the Air Force, specifically the Air Force, gives us. I know the Navy's not much better. When you hand it to somebody who is working at a small outfit in Reno and they go, what is this? You have to remember that not everybody's seen that. Everybody knows what a logbook looks like and everybody knows that it's a legal document. They don't know what the Air Force printouts are.
And, yep.
And what you said, like, I wish if Milkeep would, I know Milkeep wasn't around in 2011 when I started doing this. So I look back and I go, well, I'm not going to be trying to update my Delta logbook anytime soon. I know plenty of guys who do, and I wish I would have started it. Maybe it'll be something I'll look back on here in the next year and go, all right, let's get a hold of it and start moving in the right direction. Anyways, you kind of touched on this one, but your favorite and least favorite part of the industry?
Yeah, so the variety is the most favorite, and it's also my least favorite. But it's where the you need to be able to apply the flight discipline that you learned in your military career to your Part 91 GA operations. And all of the things that you learned are still valid, even if the airplane you're flying is, 100 horsepower, single engine piston airplane and not a twin engine turbojet. So bring that in and that will help you handle the drawbacks. Now, for our sake from High Country Air Service, one of the things that we do before we ever send a subcontractor out is we vetted the client. So we're not going to sign a contract with a client and send subcontractors out if we think that their operation is shoddy or is not going to provide an appropriate level of safety for the subcontractor. But on the flip side, the great thing is the variety and all the different airplanes that you can fly and the different places you can go and tiny little airports and the variety of operations. It's just mind boggling all of the different things that you can do in this market space.
Yeah, that's for sure. And then finally, your own memory item, your last parting shot to let these people know what they need to be thinking about, because I think sometimes we need to hear it from other people.
So I like to say that, and I probably stole this from somebody else, no one has a monopoly on good ideas. There are good ideas all over the place. And I was fortunate enough to get to do the Navy exchange for pilot training, the joint specialized undergraduate pilot training down in Pensacola, Whiting Field, and then again in Corpus Christi. And as I was headed down there, coming from a strictly Air Force background, there were a lot of Air Force guys going to Air Force bases for Air Force pilot training that were my friends, and they would, just kind of badmouth the Navy. What do they know? Well, turns out the Navy's been flying airplanes just as long as the Air Force, and they have some really great ideas about how to train and how to operate airplanes. And I learned a lot of great stuff from the Navy, and I felt super prepared when I transitioned finally back to an Air Force airplane and started flying C-130s. And that kind of taught me that you can get great ideas from anywhere, regardless of where you come from. So Air Force guy, got a lot of great flying ideas from the Navy. Former Air Force guy, got a lot of great flying ideas and techniques from civilian test pilots. I learned lots of great stuff from guys who operate 121 with the rigor and the discipline and the standardization. I mean, there are great ideas all over the place. And don't limit yourself to just your own personal stovepipe that you came from.
I think that's something the Air Force is battling a little bit, or has over the last few years. It's gotten a lot better. But especially in the Guard and Reserve, these units would kind of be stovepiped in the way they think about stuff. And they did not like to look externally for ideas. This is the way we always did it. And hopefully that continues to go by the wayside, because there's so many new and great ideas out there. Some of the folks that we interact with from Professional Pilots of Tomorrow, there are a lot of young regional guys in that group, and gals too, of course. But in their early 20s. They experiential learning is not part of their backgrounds really yet. However, not having experience means that you have almost a sense of wonder still about the job. And that's something that for you and I, it's kind of, it's not the same. We look at flying in an airplane in a different light that they do. And when they can share something that sparks a new idea in your head, well, I never thought of it that way. You did maybe, but it's been so long that that thought's been long erased. So I totally love that idea. It's something that we try to really take to heart at TPN and move it around the whole group. So we've talked about a bunch of different stuff. We bounce all over the place. I plan on doing another long form conversation about way more than just High Country Air Service with Dave in the future, because there's way more to cover. Dave, how can, are there any, first of all, any more parting shots that you want to throw out to the audience? And then how can they reach you? What's the easiest way to find Dave and High Country Air Service?
Sure. I think my parting shot is thank you to you and the rest of the TPN leadership, because I think the services that you guys provide are fantastic. It is with a real sense of service, I can tell, that you guys are running the organization. And I think that is everything you're doing is in the best interest of the membership. And I very much appreciate that as a former military aviator and somebody who's had to go through that transition. It's just awesome. So thank you. And then to reach the company, the website is probably the best place, highcountryairservice.com. Just go there and you'll see links to our social media feeds. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And then you can also send me an email if you want. firstname.lastname@highcountryairservice.com, all one word. And that's about it.
Awesome. I'll put all of that in the show notes for you, those of you interested in getting a hold of Dave, whether it's to drop off a resume, talk more about High Country, or just shoot the breeze about TPN stuff. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Hope you can hit the subscribe button so we get a few more of those metrics for the Apple and Stitcher groups out there to send more pilots and interested parties our way. We've got a lot more cool podcasts coming up. And I hope that if you have ideas, that you send them our way as soon as you can. Again, fly safe, keep the shiny side up in the air and the greasy side down towards the ground. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Adam. See ya.